My next guest, Anthony Knott, joined the Metropolitan Police in 1971, which was a very different world from that of today. He describes his early experiences at the Met, including the arrest of a man for murdering a prostitute in King's Cross. He was present when a fellow police officer was almost stabbed to death and witnessed an act of police brutality when he interrupted the beating of a petty criminal in a cell. He transferred to a county force in Dorset in 76, where not so long after his promotion to detective sergeant, he engaged in what would be a 10-long investigation into the disappearance of Monica Taylor and the eventual conviction of her husband Peter for what was the almost perfect murder. He's written about it in a new book called Investigating the Almost Perfect Murders. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK. Anthony Knott, good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Charles. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure is all mine. It's interesting, isn't it, when we talk about the Metropolitan Police in the early 70s. It's only 50 years or so, or less than 50 years since those early days, but the Met has changed almost unrecognisably since then.
Yes, it needed to. I was a country boy, born and brought up in Devon, small town. I wanted to join the Met. It was London's an exciting place, certainly in the early 70s. London really did swing, Carnaby Street and so on. So I went up into a very vibrant city, and I'd hardly ever spoken to a policeman. I'd certainly never seen a criminal in my life. And I'm sort of plunged into working in central London at Holborn, and it was like landing on Mars, I've got to say. Two things about it. There was the bad. There was, at the time I joined, there was a commander of the flying squad. Ken Drury. He was arrested for his association with an organized criminal and his stripper wife, and he was in prison. So he was like a chief constable rank, you could say. And Bill Moody was a detective chief superintendent on the obscene publication squad. He was involved in recycling seized pornographic material back into the industry again. The police had taken it. They'd fingerprinted stuff. People had been charged, and yet he was selling back obscene material, and the same was happening with drugs. Drugs were being seized by the police and getting recycled back to drug dealers again. It was a dreadful situation, and it was in fact the senior CID officers who were the worst. So it was a culture of corruption that was coming downward, which is the worst thing for any organization. And it took Robert Mark in between 1972 to 77 to really tackle the corruption problem. Having said that, I just want to emphasize that there were both uniform and particularly uniform and CID officers getting beaten up, assaulted, shot in their ordinary duty. So we got to remember that there's the two things mixed together. And I would say that most policemen view corrupt policemen as traitors. I mean, as the Lord Haw of the organisation. They're letting down the brave people that serve.
If you look back at the 70s, and I mean, a lot of us will think, you know, this police force in the 70s is almost like the famous TV series of the time, The Sweeney. But there was an upsurge, you could say, in violent crime, in armed robbery, in bank robbery, with, you know, with people using firearms. And that hadn't been seen on the streets of London before. So that was a very difficult and challenging time for the police, full stop, in the metropolitan area.
And certainly where I worked around Hatton Garden, armed robberies were unfortunately quite frequent, and it was very dangerous. Police officers were being shot, members of the public were being shot, and sometimes the laws of evidence to actually convict somebody were actually quite strict, and for example, the right to silence, which was an ultimate right at that time. It's changed since then. But there were a lot of legal obstacles in the way of the police. And I'm afraid what happened is that particularly in the early 70s, there was a culture that, well, if the evidence wasn't there and you knew he did it, there tended to be a bit of a makeup of the facts to support a charge. So not only have you got the corruption in relation to people taking money from criminals, you also had the fact that the police were gilding the lily in its kindest form to catch people who they thought were guilty. So you had lots of problems. They weren't all, the police were sometimes in a very difficult position, but the reality of the matter is you comply with the law. And it wasn't until after the Birmingham Six, everybody will remember the conviction of the six men for the Birmingham pub bombings, who were all threatened to be beaten up, thrown out of police station windows and so on. That really was the high watermark of the failure of the police to deal ethically with crime and criminals. And it was after then the police force changed its act entirely. So you get the corruption tackled by Robert Mark, and you get the approach to organised crime being dealt with more systematically and with proper procedures. And at the same time, it's got to be said, the legislators provided the police with more tools to do the job, and the police got more professional.
Yeah, I mean, before that was, there was very much a blurred line, wasn't there? Because if the way that you would get your information, and we, you know, again, it may only be 50 years ago, but it's a lifetime in terms of how you gather that information. But a lot of it was by informers, by drinking in the same pubs, by going to the same nightclubs, by going to the same sporting events as well-known figures within the crime world.
Yeah, that's right. And that, to some degree, still exists, and it should do, because informants are a tremendous way to clear crime. But informants require considerable professional procedures in dealing with them. So that, for example, when a detective meets an informant, he provides a contact sheet. So we have a very structured system, which I was closely involved in Dorset, in dealing with informants. And they're great. And I had good informants. I've recovered hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of stolen gear, drugs, all sorts of stuff that comes through from informants. You've got to rigorously look after your informants so his identity is not revealed. But they're an extremely good source. But you deal with them in a very professional way, not a sort of casual meeting in a pub and things are unrecorded. It's all got to be properly done and supervised by officers above the handler. So there are very strict procedures in place, and provided they're complied with, informants will remain, since Judas Iscariot, if you think about it, they will always remain a fundamental key player in law enforcement.
So it's 1976, just before the long hot summer that everybody remembers. Why did you decide to move back to what you thought was probably the sleepy enclaves of Dorset?
Well, no, I think it was a family thing, really. I was a country boy. I'd got a young family. I wanted to bring them up in the country. I like the sea. I like countryside pursuits. So I wanted a bit of that. And so I transferred to Dorset. Where I went to Weymouth, and I've got to say, it was awful. I found that the report writing procedures were incredibly bureaucratic. It was much quieter in those days, and I was bored to tears, having worked in central London and, you know, armed robbers all over the shop. And you're suddenly down in sleepy Dorset. It wasn't so. It was sleepy Dorset. Unfortunately, it's not so sleepy now. I used to deal with quite a few heroin addicts in central London. When I got to Dorset in 1976, there weren't any. The drug plague had not arrived. It has now, I'm sad to say. But in those days, it was still sort of 20 years behind everywhere else. And unfortunately, some of the worst sides of the modern world caught up with Dorset. But although it's sleepy Dorset, we got a fair bit of crime and have over my career, and some very interesting cases too, which, of course, I go through in the book.
So, I mean, one of the most interesting ones is that, because you were promoted to detective sergeant as well, which meant you were investigating these, was the case of Monica Taylor. And
yeah.
Tell me a little bit about who the main players were, or who these real people were in this particular...
Well, very briefly, that was in the happy days before the police cuts occurred, where the CID and the uniform officers were based in numerous police stations throughout Dorset. And our interaction was as a team, as it should be. And I remember it well. It was an April day, and a young PC came up to me, and he was going on to nights, and he, for a week, had been dealing with a missing person called Monica Taylor. She was a hotelier's wife, and appropriately, the hotel that she had been living in, which her husband owned and ran, was called the Costa del Sol in Sea Road in Boscombe.
Right.
And so we got a bit of Spanish there. There is actually another Spanish connection in a minute. He was a genial guy. The lady had disappeared from an apartment she was living in at the hotel block. She had not gone to the hairdressers when she should have done. She had not met her father, and it was in fact her daughter who eventually reported her missing about a few days later. So the uniform officer did a good job. He established that she was going out to Venezuela to see her son. Everything appeared normal, and so I went down to make inquiries because the uniform lad had to carry on with his night shifts. So I took the case on, went down and saw Peter, a genial chap in his 50s, hardworking. He'd built the business up from just one building, and he'd bought the next door one, and he'd knocked them together and so on. And he'd built the business up and worked hard. A very genial fellow. He explained that his wife had, he felt that she'd had a nervous breakdown. She tried to commit suicide a year before, and she tried to commit suicide a year before that. The reason for that is they were getting a divorce. It was, he said it was, that they were okay with each other, that she got on with him, but she was upset and could never accept the divorce. Now, a red flag was that he had moved his mistress, who was a Venezuelan lady, into the same apartment block. He'd made this hotel into apartments. So his wife had one, and he lived in another with his mistress. Well, that's not going to be a good mix. But he described that she was okay but depressed, and he thought that he didn't know where she was. He thought she'd probably committed suicide because she'd been in Sudan's psychiatric hospital for treatment following her suicide attempts. So she took me down to her apartment. It was clean and tidy. There were dishes in the sink. The bed was made. There were family photographs on the bed spread out, which he said was how what had happened the last time she tried to commit suicide. And there was an empty bottle of Disprins by the side of the bed. But apart from that, he said it's a complete mystery. Well, I then sort of plodded on with the investigation. I established that she had indeed gone into a psychiatric hospital, and her psychiatrist, when acquainted with the facts, made a statement to say that he thought that she was suicidal and that was the possible outcome of her disappearance. We never found a body. As the leaves of summer died away and the undergrowth died, we thought that, or my bosses thought that she would turn up in the New Forest, the body would be found. That's actually not uncommon. That sort of thing does happen, unfortunately.
Right.
But in this case, it didn't. So I made a few, I then start plodding around then, because there's something in me that thinks I just don't like this. I appreciate the facts, the suicide attempts. He's genial. But I check his background, and he's got a conviction for handling stolen motor cars some years before. I then did some old-fashioned, again, a lot of this is old-fashioned policing. I knocked on doors of adjoining hotels and buildings, and I found a woman who knew Monica very well. And in fact, she had a bag full of papers that Monica had given her, which included some diaries. And in the diary, she described how Peter had beaten her and abused her. There was also an affidavit in there from a solicitor who I went to see. And the solicitor described Monica as, although she had been 2 years earlier, she'd been depressed and down. He said she was getting stronger. And actually, although she disappeared on the Friday, the following Wednesday, there should have been a financial hearing at a civil court over the divorce in which she was claiming half the hotel. So we're now getting a motive here, quite a serious motive. And then really fate plays a hand in this. As a DS at Boscombe, I was dealing with prisoners most days. And there was a particular day when there was a burglar in, and there were none of the lads were available to deal with him. So I thought, well, I'll deal with that to help them out. Normally, I wouldn't deal with a shop burglary, but I jumped in my car, went to Bournemouth where he was locked up, and spoke to him. It was a chap called, I've called him Peter Rabbit, his identity I've kept secret. Mm-hmm. And Peter, he coughed the burglary, made a statement, and then we sat back and talked about local crime, because that's what you do with when you've got a prisoner in. You find out what's going on in the locality, and he was amenable to talk. And he told me about a burglary that was going to occur in Southbourne. So he knew the house, and it was going to be broken into the next day. So I said, will you show me? So he did. So I took him while he was in custody. We drove in my car, went to Southbourne. He pointed out the house. And on the way back, he said, oh, there's an old bloke here. He meant a bloke in his 50s, by the way. He said, there's an old bloke in there who takes stolen gear. I said, okay, show me where that is. So, of course, guess where we drive past? The Costa del Sol. So Taylor now is, it seems, receiving wines and spirits and cigarettes and so on, and he's selling them in his bar. But he only deals with local Bournemouth criminals, which is interesting, so just hold that one in your head as well. I take Peter back, and he's just dealt with in the normal process of things. I contacted a surveillance unit I've got. They plotted up on the house that was going to be broken into, and they capture a whole team of burglars, which is, in fact, it's a father and son operation. But I thought that was the end of that. But it wasn't, because later that day, the sergeant who's dealing with the burglars gave me a ring, and he said, I've got this chap Matthews here, who was, I think, in his late 50s, early 60s, whose sons were banged up. He said, I've got some information. Will you let me out? Will you let my boys out if I give you some information about Monica Taylor? So the DS immediately is on the phone to me. I immediately get in the car and I'm down to Bournemouth lockup to see Matthews. And I go in and see him, and I'm a very straight guy, and I have been all my career. I says, listen, I don't know what you've got to tell me. You and your boys are going to go to court tomorrow, and you're almost certainly going to get remanded in custody, because burglary dwelling, certainly at that time, would attract a custodial sentence, and usually people were remanded in custody. I said, all I can tell you is if you give me some good information, I'll write a letter for the judge at the trial. But that's the best I can do for you, which is, in fact, quite a legal process. It's called a text.
Right.
Anyway, Matthews did, in fact, give me a very long statement about his association with Taylor. He told me that he would steal, that him and Taylor were involved in stealing cars, replating them and selling them on. So he was an original criminal associate. He would put stolen gear through Peter Taylor's Costa del Sol hotel, and that they had a good relationship, and they did know all the major criminals in Bournemouth, which, of course, Matthews was one of them. He mentioned that Taylor mentioned to him he'd like him to help. Would he help him kill his wife? And Matthews said no, and he explained about the divorce situation and how Monica was becoming a pain, and he wanted to get rid of her, and he wanted to make it look like an accident or a burglary gone wrong. But Matthews didn't want to know about murder. He was, you hear this phrase occasionally, he was a genuine old-fashioned criminal, and he didn't want to know about murder. So he said he'd try and find somebody to do it. So Matthews didn't want to find anybody, and eventually he gave Taylor a cock and bull story that he tried, but he couldn't find a hitman for Taylor. So he said he didn't have a lot to do with him after that because he was worried, and then some weeks later, he saw in the Bournemouth Echo, the local paper, that Monica Taylor was reported missing, and Matthews started to worry about it. And, of course, it wasn't until he told us this. So we've got a witness there to a conversation. There was a bit more to it. It's illustrated in the book.
Right.
But there was some key evidence. But it wasn't enough. Because what you've got, because I consulted with it wasn't the Crown Prosecution Service at that. I can't remember if it was them or our own solicitors. But it was deemed there wasn't enough. We got the evidence of one criminal against another criminal. And that's all we've got. One person's word against another. It was deemed not enough. So I'm struggling here. I interview Taylor again, and he's as genial as can be. And he just happened to mention that whilst he was out buying hydrochloric acid, he bumped into somebody who thought they saw Monica in Hampshire. That was a cock and bull story, but it was interesting how he mentioned hydrochloric acid. So another key goes into this case building, if you like. Well, so we still haven't got a body. I still haven't got enough evidence. I've got Monica's photograph on my notice board looking at me saying, you haven't found me. And I'm carrying this. It's a weight I'm carrying around. Although it's written off as a missing person, I'm just not happy with it. So, again, rather like the Peter case, I'm in my office in Winton a few years later. It was a Sunday afternoon, and I'm clearing paperwork. It's quiet. I'm a detective inspector by now. And we get a call for the, I won't do the accent, but it was a guy with a South London accent, phoned up, wanting to speak to a colleague of mine. and he wasn't on duty. I said, he was another inspector. We did weekend about. I said, he's off this weekend. Can I help? And he explained a little bit. He said, well, I've been approached. I want to speak to him because I've got some information. Somebody wants me to kill somebody. I said, oh, right. I said, well, give me a brief overview, and he'll come and see you tomorrow. This guy didn't live in Dorset. He lived elsewhere. And he explained that he'd been approached by Peter Taylor to kill his son-in-law. So, because my ears are more than pricked up.
Right.
And I said, well, I dealt with the disappearance of Monica. He said, I knew Monica. She was a lovely lady. So, anyway, the long and the short of it is, we met up with the informant. We then go through a procedure, which I'm very careful about, Giles, because I don't want to explain how police use undercover officers and how we do things, because there's some considerably deep tactics involved, because we don't want to reveal our informant. And the end result, after a long undercover operation, our officers taped up, get the evidence that Taylor wants to kill his son-in-law, again, because he's getting divorced. There's a divorce between Taylor's daughter and son-in-law. And again, money is the key to it. And again, Taylor is involved with things like saying it needs to look like an accident or a burglary gone wrong, which, of course, is what he said previously to Matthews. So the end result is that Taylor gets arrested. He blanks everything. It's a no-comment interview. As professional criminals, we'll always adopt a no-comment interview. But luckily, we got it all on tape, chapter and verse. So I was able to play those tapes to Taylor. And having pursued him for 10 years, I think it'd be difficult to describe the satisfaction I felt in firing in these missiles into him and bringing this guy down. And he eventually pleaded guilty to solicitation to commit murder, but not guilty to the murder of Monica, which we managed to charge him thanks to a brave decision by the Crown Prosecution Service. Our barrister was excellent, a chap called John Aspinall QC. Sadly, he's no longer with us. He is a brilliant barrister. And so we eventually end up with a trial at Winchester, something like just under 11 years later, and Taylor is convicted of the murder. So I've got to say, it was extremely satisfying. It's sad not to have ever recovered the body, but at least we got the record straight with regards to Monica. And there's lots to this, lots of strands in there, but that story I tell in the book, as I do another similar case involving a guy called Russell Causley. But as we haven't got all day, I won't go into that one.
Indeed.
But the book is full of that type of crime investigation. And I try and get across that it's actually a team effort, murder investigations, with the police officers, both uniformed CID, and of course with the lawyers and the barristers. So it's got to be seen in its proper context, and it does irritate me sometimes when I watch a detective program on the TV, which actually I rarely do, is it annoys me that it seems to be just one or two very clever people are able to detect a crime without the legwork that's actually involved in it.
It's quite interesting because when I speak to forensic, I've interviewed quite a few forensic scientists, and they say that, you know, since the CSI series has come out, everybody in their dog is now an expert in forensics as well.
Yeah, that's right. Forensics is wonderful, but again, with all science, I actually deal with one case in here, a murder in Bridport, which was a mystery insofar as it's great if you've got a knife in the back and the guy's lying there and he's obviously been murdered, but not all murder cases are like that. Some are actually appear to be accidents and are not. They appear to be suicides and are not. That's why the police have got to be very questioning when they go into cases of sudden deaths, that we've got the facts right. And the case in Bridport, which I talk about, is actually, I call it murder and the problems with timing, because the timing was key insofar as we found the body on a Wednesday. I was told by a forensic scientist he probably died on the Tuesday, so my initial press release was looking for people who could, you know, in and around the scene of the crime on the Tuesday and the Wednesday. In fact, he died on the Monday.
Right.
So science is great, but you have to be very, very careful how you deal with things.
Isn't it?
And there are actually other cases I mentioned, including a homophobic killing where there were blood splatterings were very important in the case. but then the scientists became a bit, well, it could have been this or it could have been that. So forensic science is great, but it's not always totally and absolutely bang on. There's sometimes a bit of margin. And in criminal cases, you can't do with margins because it's got to be exact, really.
Isn't it interesting, though, the fact that really a lot of this comes out from you just taking on an everyday burglary and then having a chat with the suspect or the burglar and him saying, oh, I know something. I mean, that's old-fashioned, isn't it? That's just old, in a world of high-tech sort of reactive policing, that harks back to, you know, doing the groundwork.
And even house-to-house inquiries, banging on doors, just going around asking people, and certainly checking with criminals. And you've got to penetrate that criminal community, working closely with for CID and Uniform to be close together, because quite often I found, and that's the importance of that kind of teamwork, is that you'll get an early-turn Uniform officer will patrol, and he will see something. The late-turn officer will patrol, and he'll see something else. And even the night guy will see something. They might be three different bits of thing, but with the detective in the middle, quite often talking to them, you suddenly start finding that the Uniform officers are building a pattern of something. And it's that teamwork and analysing these various little bits of data that you get places. And as you say, it's not all high tech. I've got to say, detectives today are spoiled with the, you know, their ability to interrogate IT and so on. We had really none of that in my time. It was the more old-fashioned way. That old-fashioned way always works.
Interesting, interesting indeed. What do you hope that people take from your book?
Most importantly of all, because I've been a public servant, you've always got a desire to serve. I'm not into making money, if you like. I've got my police pension and I'm fine. And apart from being a bit wet in Dorset, day in, day out, unlike you over there. What I want people to take away is a bit of crime prevention. If there is a man out there who thinks that he can murder his wife, get rid of the body, and he can get away with it, well, it's highly likely he'll be caught. He may think he can do it, but he might think that he can get all the assets of the marriage. But think again, because there's going to be a copper somewhere who's not going to be happy, and he's going to keep this nagging issue with him until he solves it. And that basically is the same in two of the particular cases I talk about. Is that human aspect? So it's a bit of crime prevention advice. If your marriage is unfortunately turning turtle, go and see a divorce solicitor and take a financial hit. That's what you got to do. So I want that message out there. And I think the other message is for people thinking about joining the police or even in it, that I've made mistakes, plenty of them, and I do mention various ones. Ones was actually with an informant. It's very easy to make mistakes. You will make mistakes in life, but I want to put a few of them out there. And one of my mistakes, of course, was listening to the science in the murder case where I thought that it was the Tuesday or Wednesday when the guy was killed, when in fact he was killed on the day before. So again, it's being questioning of science and processes, and I want to get the message out there, maybe to young bobbies, maybe for people that are thinking of joining the service, I'm giving you all the successes and some of the failures.
The book is called Investigating the Almost Perfect Murders. It's by Anthony Knott. It's out now on Pen and Sword True Crime. Anthony, if people want to find out more about you or your books, I know you've written several, including your time in Kosovo as well. Do you have a website, or can they just find you by popping your name into the search engine?
If you just put my name into the into Google, you'll come up with the... With both books. Investigating Organized Crime and War Crimes deals with Kosovo, Bosnia, Iraq, and latterly Israel and Palestine. But I mean, Iraq is an interesting one because I got involved at the end of an investigation into the disappearance of Margaret Hassan, a wonderful woman, an aid worker who was murdered. And I have particularly strong views on the issue of negotiating with terrorists. And that's all listed in there as well.
We'll look forward to looking about and perhaps speaking about that book at some point in the future. But this book is called Investigating the Almost Perfect Murders. It's by Anthony Knott. It's a brilliant read. Anthony, thank you so much for your time today.
That's very kind. Thank you very much for having me on your programme.